There's a shot from 80,000 feet, a little bit of a curvature of the Earth. That's looking out one window. So if you extend that curvature through the front of the windscreen and around to the other side, you can see a very definitive curvature up there. Very dark purple. Stars come out after you get about, I'd say, 45 degrees above the horizon line. You can see the stars out all during the day. There's a shot from a U2. Again, a little curvature there. That's Lake Tahoe in the background. On the descent, start down from 80,000 feet and Mach 3. Start your descent about 200 miles out. Come back to, out of the afterburner. We've been cruising all the time now in afterburner. This airplane, unlike the Concorde, which comes out of afterburner when it was flying and maintaining Mach 2, we always stayed in afterburner and had to be there to stay at Mach 3 or greater. Start your descent. Then we'd level off on the way down about 25,000 feet, bore into the next refueling track. The tankers would always be 2,000 feet above us, so he'd be at 27,000 feet. And again, he's been up there on station 30 minutes before us. It may be the same set of tankers we had on our way up. It may be another set on the way back down. You just never know. And refuel, and like I said, go somewhere else or return. Air traffic control, unlike many of you pilots out there, you always have to talk to them. Once we got above 60,000 feet on the way up, we turned everything off on the airplane. Anything it emits, all the radios, the transponder, everything goes off because the bad guys can pick it up. The airspace is all yours anywhere in the globe because no one's up there and there's no air traffic control. So the air traffic controllers at Mildenhall and over Okinawa, as far as they know, our flight plan dropped off the face of the earth at 60,000 feet. They had no more idea where we were going than the man in the moon. Some of you might have heard this saying, when you come down, this is before we did the radio silent procedures. As we came down, we would also turn on our radios and start talking to ATC, and we did that in the States. Now, stateside's different, because this is all training. We always stayed on ATC, even if we're at 80,000 feet, because we developed emergency, you want instant recognition of where you're at, so you can come down with emergency. So, stateside, we didn't turn everything off like I just mentioned, only on operational sorties. So stateside, guys would be up here at 85,000 feet, and they'd call ATC and said, request flight level 600, and ATC, one controller came back and says, if you can get up there Aspen 30 to 600, it's all yours. And he said, no, I'm descending to 600. There's a joke that goes around on the internet, so I just thought I'd bring it up, but it has happened. A lot of air traffic controllers were not very used to. Our call sign in the States was a static call sign of Aspen. Once they got used to us, they knew that it was an Aspen, they knew it was an SR-71 generally. Now the crew, the mobile crew is waiting for you to come back. They've been out there 30 minutes before your arrival time. They're on a perpendicular taxiway. They've been talking to them on their radio if you need be, but otherwise you maintain radio silence. Final approach speed on the SR, about 190 knots. Touchdown at 160. You can see the high deck angle, very poor visibility right over the nose, but very easy to get a grease job out of this airplane. Very easy. There is so much ground effect. That whole Delta platform has so much ground effect underneath that. A whole cushion of air just holds you and you get a grease job every time. You had to work at getting a bad landing. You really did. Big drag chute comes to a big screeching halt. It really throws you forward in the cockpit, and a lot more tug than I've taken a barrier with an F4 over at Udorn, a midfield barrier, back 13 barrier. It throws you in the seat when you take it, but I'll guarantee you, when you pop this drag chute, it's more of a tug going forward than taking a barrier. Roll out, jettison the drag chute, taxi back in. Again, mobile is going to lead you back in because of the FOD damage. The physiological people, they come up, get your helmets, your gloves, and all your classified checklist and everything. The crew there shaking handsy, that's Terry Pappas and John Manzi. At the foot of the ladder, you do a quick debrief. The maintenance officer wants to know how the airplane is, any major problems. The intel folks want to know any MIGs, any sightings, any SAM firings. And then the deck commander, he just wants to know how it went from an operational standpoint, did everything go smooth? And so you just brief real quick, maybe 5-10 minutes at the foot of the ladder. Now here's a good mobile crew. Notice what's in the hand. I'll tell you what, after breathing 100% oxygen for 4, 5, 6, 7 hours, when you come down, that beer tastes so good. And it goes right to your head. Now the hard part begins. And these are the guys and gals that I, again, take my hat off to. The pilots have the glamorous job of flying the airplane. The maintenance folks, the refuelers, the tanker guys, all these people to get one sortie off work day and night, and we get to fly this airplane, which is a real privilege. Now, once you land the airplane, the intel folks have to stay up all night making meaningful information out of all the sensor information, and they do that all throughout the night to be able to disseminate it. All the photographic interpretation has to be done as well. So these guys are the real yeomen that do the hard work. Little summary for those 22 years. Over 17,000 sorties, over 53,000 hours were flown, over 11,600 were all at Mach 3 or greater, and of the whole time, that 22 years, 86 operational pilots and 86 operational navigators in the backseater. That's only the people who flew out on operational missions. If you count up the generals and the senators and the congressmen and the four-star, it goes up in the hundreds because everyone wanted to have their one-time flight in the airplane. But of the operational crews, 86 only flew it on the reconnaissance mission. So it's a very small cadre of people, much smaller actually than the astronaut corps. And very, very small. Retirement, they were all retired in 1990. But at the insistence of Congress, in 1995, they were brought back and reactivated. We brought back three airplanes and three crews, reactivated for 2 years, got them modified to be even more capable. Nothing happened to any, no contingency, no crisis around the world, so they were never used operationally. On October 13th of 1997 was the final retirement of the SR-71s, and ever since then, all the airplanes were put in museums. NASA, National Air and Space Museum, National Air and Space Administration picked up three of our airplanes out at Edwards, and they kept flying theirs until about 1999, somewhere in there, and then they even retired there. So all the airplanes are at museums all around the United States, and we have one over in England at the Duxford Imperial War Museum. However, those of us who flew it believe what was the average mission time? Our shortest mission on the books was 57 minutes from takeoff to landing. And it happened over at Okinawa. Unrefueled, we took off with a 65,000 pound fuel load, took off at Okinawa, afterburners cooking, made a climbing right-hand turn, leveled off at 80,000 feet, Mach 3, made one pass through the Korean DMZ from the northeast to the southwest, right smack dab down the middle of the DMZ, gathered intelligence on North Korea, descending left-hand turn, a little bit of intelligence on Red China, came back on Okinawa, touchdown 57 minutes later. That's the shortest one on the books. The longest missions were all done during the Yom Kippur War of 1973, when the Arabs and Israelis were battling it out. The president at the time told them, guys, get your troops back and we'll get a peace going, and they said, we will. Well, we flew 9 sorties, all of which were over 11 hours and 20 minutes, and those are the longest sorties we ever flew, all the way from the East Coast, all the way into the Mediterranean, back out to the East Coast. That product was delivered directly and hand-carried right to the president, and it brought, over a 4-day period of getting the photography, he said, look, both you countries are lying. We know where your troops are at and where your tanks are at. I told you to move them back, and that started the Arab-Israeli peace accord over there, and that's probably one of the most influential missions that we ever flew that actually had an impact on the whole world and the possibilities of what could happen from that. So that's our longest and shortest, a little bit over 11 hours and 20 minutes, and 57 minutes is the shortest. I'll take one more. Up front. Why did the pirates have to have 400 PS? Why do tires have to have 400 PSI of nitrogen? Why? I don't know. high-pressure tires, that's what it was. It was 400 PSI. Yeah. And it was gaseous nitrogen for obvious reasons. Nitrogen is inert. So if you have an explosion or something, you don't have a increase your potential for a major fire. So nitrogen being inerted. Gentleman asks, has any other country developed an airplane like the SR-71? The closest one is the Russians' MiG-25M model. If you remember back in your history bank, Viktor Belenko defected to Japan out of Russia. He was in a MiG-25M model. And we got to debrief with him when he was still pretty much a civilian. He comes up to Oshkosh a lot, actually. I meet him up here quite a bit. But we got to debrief him with the CIA when he first defected, and we got to ask him a lot of questions. And it didn't have the performance capability to come up and intercept us. It could get to 2.8 Mach at about the most. And when it did get to 2.8, it trashed the engine out so bad, the engine had to be replaced. And it wasn't any threat to us at all. So that's the only airplane I know that could come close to it as far as an interceptor. I don't know of any airplane that's designed to be a high-speed, high-altitude platform like us in terms of sensors, whereas the U-2 is a low-speed, non-threat environment. We always took great pride that we're the only aircraft that can penetrate a highly defended area, and unlike the U-2, it has to be a standoff platform because it can still get shot down today, just like Gary Powers did in 1960. So I'm going to wrap it up, and I thank you very much, and if you want to hear some more, I'll be there Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Thank you.